You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome back, everyone, to Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast coverage of the Houston Rockets. I'm your host, Ben Dubose. As we chat on this Thursday, what a glorious Thursday it is in the city of Houston, Texas. Yes, the Rockets did win last night, 119-97, over the New York Knicks at Madison Square Garden, improving the Rockets' record to 6-3 on the year. We will break down that in just a little bit. But of course, the reason it's a glorious day, the Astros are world champions for just the third time in Houston sports history in the three major sports, basketball, baseball, and football. Houston is a world champion for the first time since the Rockets did it, the second of back-to-back titles in June 1995. Houston has a champion. The Astros won Game 7 of the World Series, taking the series 4-3 from the LA Dodgers with a 5-1 win in Game 7. And first things first, props to them. This city is on fire. What an amazing run it's been for the Astros, and a perfect time for the city of Houston, too, considering the hell that Hurricane Harvey has brought to this region over the past couple of months. It's been incredible resilience from the city, no matter what, but then to see that reflected on the field with this inspiring Astros run, just tremendous. And so I'm not going to lead off talking about the Rockets, even though this is a Rockets podcast. Let's give props to the Astros, because first and foremost, this is Astros Day around the city of Houston. But beyond just strictly giving credit to the Astros from a baseball perspective, and they're a great team, I think there are some effects from this that directly impact the Rockets and the broader Houston sports community as well. So that's what I want to lead off this podcast discussing. And as I see it, there's a couple of areas. Now, one negative effect I want to kind of push back on very, very quickly. I've seen some Rockets fans and Texans fans, not many, just a very small minority, wishing that there was more coverage of their team and wondering what this means for Houston sports fans moving forward. I would not worry about that at all, folks. Just look at Boston. Boston, historically, is a Red Sox and a Celtics town, and yet the Patriots have been the most successful organization in sports over the past 15 years. If the Rockets win games, they are going to get all the coverage they need. Same goes for the Texans. So no, I don't think that because the Astros are doing well, that all of a sudden it might take people away from the Rockets or the Texans or basketball or football or whatever your concern is. No, if you win, there is room for that. If anything, I think there's upward mobility for more people to become diehard sports fans in general after seeing how fun and how galvanizing this run was around Houston. So no, I don't see this Astros run as potentially a negative for the Rockets, the Texans, in terms of taking away fans or media coverage. No, when it comes to the Rockets and media coverage, if they win games, that situation is going to take care of itself. I can promise you guys that. So there's no need to be concerned about comparing one versus the other. The Astros' success, if nothing else, it might actually benefit the Rockets in terms of getting more people involved in sports in this city. But as far as direct benefits, I would say I see two real positives from this. And the first one, it's obvious, but I'm going to say it because I've been accused of being too pessimistic on this front. First and foremost, this makes the Houston sports community believe. Everyone from the fans, and I think there's even a trickle-down effect to the athletes and coaches themselves. And I say that as a guy who, if you follow me on Twitter, at Ben Dubose, you know over the years I have thrown out a sarcastic hashtag, Houston sports, when something bad happens in a particularly prominent moment. It's almost like expecting that other shoe to drop. That was how Reed Ryan, the president of business operations for the Astros, son of Nolan, characterized it in one of his interviews this morning. And after seeing something go right, I can tell you guys, I wake up feeling completely differently today than I did yesterday. It's amazing. It feels like the weight of the world is lifted off of my shoulders, and I'm guessing it does for many of you guys as well. And I think there is a trickle-down effect all the way through the fan base that can also have, you know, a role in terms of the athletes and coaches on the field and the environment around them in that gym. And in the case of the Rockets, when I say in that gym. And people always ask me personally, why are you so logical when it comes to, you know, off-season, big-picture discussions, you know, a lot of times here on the podcast during the week, and yet so, in you know, emotional and reactionary during the games? And my response to that is that, you know, I'm logical about the big picture because generally sports, you can build a team rationally, and over the course of seasons, years, more often than not, things are going to work out for you if you do the right things. But in terms of individual games, luck can have a big role. And so because of that, they are emotional. They are reactionary because you can do all the right things. And if you don't get the break in a given game, then you know what? It may swing an entire playoff series, and that may be all it takes to kind of turn a window for a given team. And in this American sports format where essentially, basketball is a little different because you have 4 7-game series, and that's a large enough sample that many times the cream rises to the top, although you can certainly have an unlucky injury, which the Rockets have had plenty of times over the years. But in general, in the playoff format, it makes it all the more likely that you can have 1 or 2 games where just a little bit of poor luck at the wrong time can swing a game. And then in turn, that can swing a franchise. Look back to the 2016 Western Conference Finals between the Thunder and the Warriors, when the Thunder were up, 3-2 playing at home. And if not for Klay Thompson losing his mind in the fourth quarter of that game, bringing the Warriors back, and if not for even that compounded with some unforced errors on the Thunder's end offensively, there's no chance that Kevin Durant is in Oklahoma City. The entire complexion of both of those franchises is changed because of just a few plays in, you know, an 8 to 9 minute stretch of the game. And that's how it works in playoff formats. So yes, I'm a big logical person when it comes to how are you putting a team together. I can sit here and talk about the strategy, and I believe that, you know, it doesn't guarantee you anything. It doesn't guarantee you a championship, but it should guarantee you a good team that gives you an opportunity. But when it comes to the games themselves, there's a lot of randomness. There's a lot of luck involved. And over the course of time, if that doesn't go your way, there can certainly be a cumulative psychological effect, both on the fan base, and of course that can even trickle down to the teams themselves. And, you know, sometimes I take it too far. A lot of us do, and I'm never serious, but... You know, I don't believe in curses, per se. I certainly don't think that the Red Sox or Cubs were cursed, anything like that. So, you know, no, I don't think anyone is out to get Houston. I never believe that. But I do believe in the randomness of luck. And, you know, just because you flip a coin and it's heads one time, it doesn't make it any more likely to be tails the next. And if you have enough of those that go against you, then I don't see how you can't be pessimistic. That's part of, you know, that's part of being a fan. There's just this emotional component to the games themselves that, hey, you can do all the right things when it comes to building a roster, but there are some moments that are not going to be able to be fully controlled. They're just going to happen on the fly, and you hope they go your way. And for a while, they hadn't gone Houston's way. And to tie this into the Rockets, here's the way I look at it. Both the Rockets and the Astros are very much process over results or organizations. And with the Rockets, I'll go back to the very first few years of Daryl Morey. Back in 2009, I'm sure a lot of you guys remember, the New York Times had this great feature on Shane Battier when he was one of the top defenders in the league. And of course, it broke down not just Shane, but the Rockets' progressive front office, all the great things they were doing. And as part of that story on Battier, they used an example of which he played picture-perfect defense on Kobe Bryant. They were using this to illustrate a point. Had his hand, you know, within inches of his face, never fouled him, didn't do anything wrong, got the hand right in the face, and then Kobe drilled a three anyway. And sometimes that's what happens. You can do everything right, you can reduce the chances of a shot going in to incredibly low, and then sometimes in one situation, it may still not go your way. And so that's where I go back to this logic versus emotion component. Individual games aren't logical. And many times, these individual games can swing an entire, series, and then in turn, you know, one series, like the Thunder Warriors example, can change an entire window for a franchise. And if it consistently doesn't go your way for a while, yes, there's going to be a cumulative psychological effect. And so, yeah, I'll defend myself for being emotional in the past, and I'll defend you guys as well. I think Houston fans had a right to be emotional after 22-plus years, despite having good teams, of not seeing it go their way. And so that's why you've seen a little bit of pessimism, I think, amongst fans that especially follow all three teams in Houston, because it's been very frustrating, I would say, especially because in Houston, it's not like the teams have been bad. it's actually easier to take if you're a fan of, like, the Cleveland Browns, I think. Like, the new age Cleveland Browns, since they returned in 1999, they've just been a cluster. They have just had terrible decision after terrible decision. And when you say, well, they haven't done anything, well, it's easy to say. The team has made terrible decisions, the front office. They've just done stupid thing after stupid thing. In the case of Houston, it hasn't been like that. All three major franchises have had legitimate windows. In the case of the Rockets, you've had a couple of things that haven't gone their way yet. And to their credit, they're still trying. First iteration of Daryl Morey, you had Tracy McGrady and Yao Ming, two top 10 players. Never happened that they could be healthy at the same time. That 2019, even without Tracy, they took the Lakers, the eventual champions, to seven games. And I firmly believe that if not for Yao Ming breaking his foot in game three of the playoff series, a potential what ended up being a career-ending foot injury, then if not for that, I think there's a good shot that the Rockets beat the Lakers and win the entire thing. That was unlucky. Then, of course, you're not even able to extract any compensation because Tracy and Yao broke down so quickly. And so essentially went through 3 years of nothingness there where the Rockets were just on that mediocrity treadmill. And then even when they were good enough, because Daryl Morey is amongst the best in the world at what he does, even when they were good enough to get out of that, look what's happened in the James Harden era. Harden is fabulous. He is an incredible player. But in the past 5 years, the Damian Lillard shot, if not for Damian Lillard making a crazy shot in under a second, that series, when Dwight was at his healthiest in Houston, is going back to a Game 7 at Toyota Center, and the Rockets, if they win that, are going up against a Spurs team that they were 4-0 against that year, the eventual champion Spurs. Who knows what the hell happens? That's Damian Lillard. And then the last few years since then, they got to the Western Conference Finals, but they ran into the Warriors, who have almost just stumbled into a dynasty out of a team that just a few years ago with the same core looked kind of capped in the, you know, 50-win, 6-seed range. And now the Warriors have Kevin Durant, and it's probably the most talented team in the freaking history of the NBA, maybe on a proportional basis, the most talented team in the history of sports. That's unlucky. The Rockets this year would probably be an overwhelming favorite in most seasons in NBA history. They're not now because the bar is that high with the Warriors. And that's crappy luck, and that sucks. And to the Rockets' credit, they're not quitting. That's one thing I love about Daryl Morey. But in terms of being a fan, is it frustrating that you can do all these things right and then, you know, this random event such as Kevin Durant making just a pretty much an unprecedented decision to join a team that had won 73 games, some random event like that can dramatically alter the outlook for your franchise? Yeah, it's really frustrating. And I get it when I hear Rockets fans concerned about that. And it's similar stories for, you know, the Astros and the Texans. The Astros finally got it done, but you look, the 98-win team, that was after the 95 Rockets championship. 98-win team, Astros won 102 games, still the most in franchise history in a regular season. Lost 3-1 in the first round. That was with Randy Johnson. Until this year, that was the best team in Astros franchise history, in my opinion, and they won one playoff game. 2005, they got to the World Series. Every game in that World Series was close. Every game was there for the taking in the ninth inning, multiple ones tied, and yet the Astros did not even win a single game. 2015, the Astros had the Royals, the eventual World Series champions, beaten. They were done. The Astros were up 6-2 in the eighth inning. The manager of the Royals admitted that he was thinking of what he was going to say in his post-game address to the media and how he wanted to credit the Astros. That could have been a wide-open year for the Astros. It wasn't. So these things have happened all three teams over the course of these last 22 years. It's not like they've been the Cleveland Browns. They have done a lot of really good things in terms of putting winners together, teams that on paper have great chances to win it all. I haven't even talked about the Texans yet. I almost skipped them. But folks, look back to 2011. The Texans were playing amazing football. That was their most complete team offensively and defensively. And then after their fourth consecutive win, blowout fashion in Tampa Bay, on just a random quarterback dive to try and get some separation from the goal line, Albert Haynesworth basically belly flops on Matt Schaub's foot, and it breaks. That's the Liz Frank fracture, and all of a sudden, this great Texans team, no matter, they had so many things going for it, but you weren't going to do anything with a fifth-round rookie, T.J. Yates, in the playoffs. We all know that. And then the next year, the Texans started off 11-1. So many things going right. They were the talk of the league. They were Super Bowl frontrunners. And after starting 11-1, of course, they had the letter jackets just craziness in New England, got blown out on Monday Night Football, and they couldn't even get a bye. Not only did they not even get home field throughout the playoffs, they could not even get a bye. Fell all the way to the 3 seed, lost a catastrophically emotionally devastating game, the game at Indianapolis to close the year, and then, of course, quietly went out of the playoffs by a pretty healthy margin, round two in New England. All of those things were teams that looked built to potentially go the distance, and then for varying reasons, they didn't. And when that happens over 22 years, yeah, there can be a cumulative psychological effect from that. And it's not like, you know, it's that common. I hear a lot of folks saying on Twitter that, oh, you know, stop being so emotional. You really think this only happens to Houston? Actually, it's pretty rare. Until last night, Houston was the only city with an NFL team that, no, let me rephrase. Houston was the only NFL city with a baseball team that did not have a ring in either. And in the case of football, they haven't even been to a Super Bowl. And so, you know, despite all the success of the Rockets, that was 22 years ago, and it was all largely due to one transcendent legendary figure in Hakeem Olajuwon. Things haven't gone Houston's way since then, and that's even with a lot of teams that had windows on paper that were wide open. Again, 22 years with a lot of really good teams. And it goes back further than that. Of course, you know, Houston's been a major player in the American professional sports scene going back 60, 70 years. Until last night, one team had won titles, and those were both basically the same generation, right back to back. So no, having a city like Houston with this many teams and this many quality franchises, Houston has had a disproportionately low amount of success when it comes to actually winning it all. So no, it isn't just a matter of, well, Houston fans are being too sensitive. This happens to everyone. No, there are some unique factors that have come to Houston. A lot of it just, quite frankly, bad luck. And that's why the Astros' win last night was so big. Because over time, it's easy to start expecting that other shoe to drop. If not the players, certainly the fans. And then I do think there could be a correlation when it comes to, you know, the mood of the city, the fans, and then you can have the level of performance in a key situation. Maybe the players, the coaches are too tense. That's why that win last night, that's why this Astros championship, beyond the obvious that, well, they're the best team in baseball, it's great for the city after Hurricane Harvey, et cetera, et cetera, that's why it's so big. Now, I'm sure some folks will ask, did you really think it wasn't going to work out for Houston? Realistically, no. I thought this was going to happen, if not this year, at some point in the near-term future, because all three teams, well, I don't know about all three, but certainly Astros and Rockets are run really, really well right now. But that's the logic side of my brain. And sports aren't always logical. These games themselves, there are all sorts of crazy little things that can swing it. And so that's why it's great to see it finally work out for Houston on the biggest stage. My guess in this is that in the aftermath of this, Houston comes together as a sports community like never before. And I think that also makes it easier, more enjoyable to be a fan of the Rockets and Texans as well. Certainly, it's going to be Astros for the foreseeable future. Hope to see a few of you guys out at the parade on Friday. But then beyond that, I think this is going to make it more fun to be a Houston sports fan. I think it's going to make people believe more throughout the city. And yes, I do think that can have a trickle-down effect, especially with the crowds and the energy and the vibe you have at Toyota Center next April, May, and hopefully June when the Rockets are going on a playoff run of their own. That's my first key takeaway on it. And that the Astros win just helps really the entire Houston sports community from a confidence standpoint. The other takeaway that I have from the Astros that I think relates to the Rockets, it's three simple words. Trust the process. Believe in your organization. If you are confident, I think the Rockets certainly are with the likes of Daryl Morey running things and a great staff beneath him. If you believe that your route is the right way to win, and certainly in the case of the Astros, Jeff Luhnow's staff knew exactly what they were doing, then stick with it. And not just, of course, people themselves, but also the people above them. In the case of the owner, Jim Crane with the Astros, now Tillman Fertitta with the Rockets. And it sounds easy to say, but it's not easy to do. There's a lot of pressure. Just look at Sam Hinkie in Philadelphia, who put together, really, his plan was a big part of why the Sixers looked to have such a promising future now. But he was, well, sacrificed. Now, of course, you see the funny shirt, Sam Hinkie died for our sins, all that kind of stuff. But basically, Philadelphia had to sacrifice Sam Hinkie, or they felt they did, for a PR win. And those things are very real considerations, because what ends up happening in these situations And tanking is the story for the Sixers in that example. And in the case of the Astros, I guess it was also tanking because certainly they were really bad 2011 through 2013. That got them some high draft picks. But it may not always be tanking. What it's really about is finding a market inefficiency, or I guess a market efficiency is a better way to put it. Some place in the team building concept that you can find a relative advantage to the way most other teams are doing it. And it just so happened that tanking was the way that worked for the Sixers, well, worked for the Astros, and maybe for the Sixers, we'll see if it actually plays out that way. It may be other ways in the future, because now, you know, you're seeing leagues try to kind of dissuade the tanking concept. The NBA has flattened the lottery odds, so it's not as easy to get a transformational player in the draft if you have the worst record as it's been before. So maybe, you know, tanking turns into something else in 5 or 10 years. But really, it's the principle is you're doing something against the status quo. You're trying to find a proportional advantage. And when that happens, well, you're inherently upsetting the status quo because you have people that are very accomplished and are making their livelihood based on the way things are commonly done. And what ends up happening in the case of a situation like the Sixers or the Astros, I'll use the Sixers because that led to someone caving in the case of Sam Hinkie being kind of forced out the door, which is that, you know, it's easy to say, hey, it doesn't matter if we're 20-62 or 41-41. If we're not winning a ring, then what does it matter? Let's just do whatever it takes to get back to a contending level quicker. Well, it's easy for us diehards to say that. But the reality is, sports has a lot of casual fans too. And there are a lot of people around the city that would much rather have a 41-41 type team. Maybe they scrape into the playoffs as an 8th seed, especially in the East, and get a little bit of excitement and buzz in the arena, even if they don't really have a shot to actually contend for a title. So yeah, you have a lot of fans in the city who aren't as diehard as we are, so you have to stand up to them. But then more importantly, you have athletes and coaches. It's a bitter pill to swallow. That your team, you know, when you are at the peak of your profession and you feel like that you're not being fully supported. And I'll be clear, these players, you know, and you'll say, well, these players, these coaches aren't that good. Even the worst players at the NBA and Major League Baseball levels are in like the top 0.01% in the world as far as what they do in terms of basketball players or basketball coaches, baseball players, baseball managers. Even the worst are still really, really talented and really good. It is their lives. And I covered some of those really bad Astros teams. And even these players, you know, Matt Dominguez, who else from those years? Cody Clark, all sorts of, any random guy you can throw out there from those awful Astros teams. Mark Krause, you can just go through so many box scores and laugh at him. But even those guys, and especially if there are some veterans in there, Eric Bedard's another one the Astros brought in. In 2013, he was their highest paid player. He was the only guy even making, I believe, like over $1 million or $2 million, and he was, you know, maybe $4 million, which is just laughably low, because of course they were saving money to spend it later, which they are doing now, reinvesting in a championship team. But you know, if you're a player, and especially if you're an accomplished veteran, yeah, you it's a bitter pill, and I'm not going to blame them for not being able to swallow to see management not giving you the support that gives you an opportunity to be the best that you can be, and I understand their position. And then what ends up happening, unfortunately, in many cases, the media is the microphone for these players or coaches. And generally, the media, and I try my best to do this, but generally the media should be objective. The media should be willing to kind of say, hey, even if these players are upset, then it's for the greater good. But many times it doesn't work that way because players, coaches, they have connections in media, and many times you have a lot of media members who basically toe the line on behalf of the players, the coaches. They want access, so they basically scratch the back of the player, and then it ends up with the player kind of firing a shot at the organization. I think back to the anonymous reliever who got on the Astros for that bullpen session with Mark Appel a couple of years ago. That was in the summer of 2014, and got up. And yeah, this guy, this reliever, who obviously was a veteran. I have my theories on who it was, but it's not really responsible for me to speculate publicly. But that's really beside the point. What ends up happening is you have a media member just basically becoming a microphone, and then all of a sudden you have this player putting significant pressure on the organization. And then many times that trickles down to the fans, and before you know it, you can have a tidal wave of PR going against you. And I'll throw out another example of the Astros. Since this is Astros Day, let's use another one. 2014, a big part of why they are where they are today is because the Astros did not sign Brady Aiken, who they drafted number one overall in 2014, ended up getting a compensatory pick number two overall in 2015, which they used on third baseman Alex Bregman, who is now a cornerstone. But in 2014, the Astros were crucified in the press. If you guys remember back then, they were crucified by many members in the media here, including very respected members at prominent publications. And, you know, I and others made the logical case for how this could turn out better, but they didn't want to hear it. Because back then, the Astros, of course, they were not a winner at that point. Now, I would point out that the Astros back then, you know, they won 70 games in 2014. That was a huge step up from 51 the year before. You could see the light at the end of the tunnel in 2014. You saw Jose Altuve, Dallas Keuchel, Colin McHugh, George Springer made his debut. You could see light at the end of the tunnel back then. But even with that light, even with the Astros having the top-ranked farm system in baseball, all this optimism, Sports Illustrated believed him enough to do that 2017 World Series Champions cover with George Springer on the cover back in June 2014. Even with all those things, when the Astros drafted Brady Aiken but ended up not signing him because, well, they noticed in the medical evaluation process some problems with his elbow, even knowing that there was all this brightness, even knowing that they had rebuilt the system, that they were close, even knowing that they'd get a 2015 compensatory pick, number two overall, they were crucified because fans had lost for that. The team had been losing for that long, and Brady Aiken, the number one pick, was supposed to be something to rally around. And, I mean, it was a beating. And it would have been so easy on that deadline day for Jeff Luhnow to say, you know what, screw it. I'm going to just sign Brady Aiken and take the risk on his elbow because Aiken was a pitcher, of course, and just give this one to the fans and or the media or whoever it may be. Or it could have been easy for Jim Crane, the owner, to say, you know what? I can't take this negative PR. I can't take the risk of fewer fans buying tickets. Do it, Jeff. I don't care if it's not, you know, I don't care what your concern is. Just do it for the PR win. The Astros didn't. They held their guns. They were not comfortable with what they discovered about Aiken's elbow in the process. And it ended up being accurate because, well, first off, Brady Aiken did end up ultimately having to have Tommy John surgery. There was a major problem with his arm and ended up being, I think he was redrafted by the Indians the following year. But then beyond that, of course, the 2015 compensatory pick ended up becoming Alex Bregman, who was a cornerstone player for a World Series champion and probably had the biggest individual hit of all, the 10th inning walk-off single in Game 5 when the Astros won 13-12 over the Dodgers on Sunday night, putting them up 3-2. So, again, it's all easy to say for us to sit here as diehards and say this is the easiest way to build a champion. And, you know, the modern age with the rules where they are now, oftentimes that means tanking. It's easy to say that, but there are a lot of external pressures that make it hard to actually do. And just look at the Sixers, even though they did a lot of things, even though they did it right, Sam Hinkie still got let go in large part because of the pressure, even though he was doing, and I think everyone around the league understands, what was in the best interest of the Sixers to get back to a contending level as quickly as possible. So kudos to owner Jim Crane, GM Jeff Luhnow, and folks involved with the Astros for trusting their confidence. I mean, trusting their process and having confidence in it eventually working out. It certainly did last night. And in the case of the Rockets, I think that's something you've seen over the years from Daryl Morey. He believes that he has a unique route to player scouting and development and all the other unique things the Rockets have going on from an analytical perspective. And it's worked out. And it hasn't always been pretty. He's been second-guessed a lot. And even though he didn't have to tank to get there, I mentioned this the other day, it wouldn't shock me if in 5 or 6 years, depending on exactly what happens in free agency, once the Harden era eventually finally concludes, and hopefully, well, maybe Harden can even be like Dirk and have a prime into his late 30s. We'll see. But Morey thought that the Sixers route was the route to go for the Rockets. It's just that Les Alexander, the owner then, would not sign off. Maybe, you know, we'll see what the tanking rules are then, et cetera, et cetera. It could be possible 5 to 10 years from now. Now with a new owner in Tillman Fertitta, maybe he will sign off. But the bottom line, the lesson to be taken here is to trust the process, and if you're confident in what you're doing, stick with it. Don't worry about the PR. And I say that as a media member. There have been times that Daryl Morey has made decisions that I didn't agree with. Now, many times he's ended up right because he knows more than I do. But the point is, no media member, we don't have the full story. And just because a media member has a harsh critique, don't let that shape your decision making. And of course, that goes all the way down to the players and coaches. Although many times what the media says is one and the same with the players and coaches, because the players and coaches are talking anonymously to the media. But yeah, the story of the Astros, more than anything else, stick with your process. If you have a good guy in the front office, if you know what you're doing, and they do in Jeff Luhnow, and I think the Rockets do in Daryl Morey, then don't worry about the external stuff. Do your thing. Believe in yourself. Have confidence. Go with your gut. Stick with it. Don't worry about the PR. Don't worry about the fans. Because you know what? If you win, which the Astros did, everything else is going to take care of itself. Now, all of that is my big picture macro level analysis. Just how to build a winning franchise, some correlations between the rise of the Astros and what the Rockets are doing over at Toyota Center. And with this being an Astros day in Houston, well, I figured that a lot of you might enjoy that. Here on Locked On Rockets, of course, we're not just about the macro. We're about the micro as well. We're about the day-to-day. And even though very few Houston fans actually watched it, yes, the Rockets did play last night and got a big, emphatic win in New York, 119-97. So, yeah, let's break it down. First things first, credit to the Rockets for letting the Houston fans focus on the Astros. I said this during the game. The Rockets this year, they're 6-3, but four of the six wins have actually been pretty close. They've only had two truly emphatic statement wins, the blowout over Dallas at home and then last night at New York, which was also a nationally televised game on ESPN. And both of those happened during Game 7 of the American League Championship Series, and then last night, Game 7 of the World Series. So if nothing else, Houston sports fans, give a shout-out to the Rockets for letting Rockets fans fully turn their attention to the Astros, courtesy of the Rockets, not only winning by a big margin, but taking care of big business very, very early. Rockets are actually up 100-74 after the third quarter last night. So yeah, they went out and did what they should do against a Knicks team that, well, they're more talented than, and then finally they played like it. And more than anything, we'll go into the individual numbers, but where I feel good about this Rockets game is I like that they responded to how Mike D'Antoni called them out. It wasn't like they were especially hot from three. They were okay. They shot 47% overall, and from three, 36.5%, 19 of 52. That's better than they have been. I mean, going into the game, they were the third worst in the NBA, but we knew that was a little flukish. What encourages me is that they won this game through largely coming out with a focus and commitment over the balance of 48 minutes. Mostly they did every minute. They were a little sluggish after the first quarter. They were 27-24, or in the first quarter, I should say. But after the first quarter, boy, the second and third quarters combined, they outscored the Knicks 76-47 over those 24 minutes. That is a staggering figure. And I think it's really good to see the Rockets respond, because D'Antoni called them out. D'Antoni, his post-game comments after the loss to Philadelphia on Monday at home, we asked him about, you know, pace of play, all sorts of little intricacies. D'Antoni didn't really take the bait. He wasn't saying that the Rockets were deficient in any one area. He just said offense, defense, whatever, that they needed more focus, that they needed more energy, more effort, that he had not seen the grit, the grinding mentality to win those types of games. And it's great to see the Rockets respond, because that shows you that the coach has their attention. It actually reminded me a little bit, and of course I was not particularly concerned about that Philadelphia game, but I will say, D'Antoni's postgame comments reminded me an awful lot of what we heard from Kevin McHale early in the 2015-2016 season. That was that disastrous 41-41 year, last year of Dwight in Houston, Ty Lawson, and the first 11 games before Kevin McHale got let go, and a big reason why he was let go, he said those types of things, and yet it had no direct correlation to the level of effort on the floor, which made it clear that he was not connecting, his words were not resonating in the locker room. So for Mike D'Antoni to essentially call out their effort, and again, it's understandable why he did. Folks, not only is there no Chris Paul, well, it's an 82-game grind, it's in October, in the case of the home games, the gym is pretty much half full because of all the attention and effort and time that's going on with the Astros these days. It's a team that's built to be a contender in May and June, and aside from not having Chris Paul, it's just a matter of they know they're going to be there in the end, and it's not like they're losing ground in the standings, because the Warriors and Spurs have had their own share of struggles early in the year. So, you know, it's nothing to worry about. I was never worried about it before. Nonetheless, Mike D'Antoni did call them out, and so it's always interesting to see how they respond, because certainly just look at the, you know, October, November in the Kevin McHale final year. It's not always easy to get those players to respond. But boy, the Rockets absolutely did respond in this game. Just a beautifully played game. Out-rebounded the Knicks, out-passed the Knicks, limited the turnovers, just 15 to 19 for New York. Just an overall great team approach from the Rockets, and particularly the starters. For James, 31 points, 9 assists. He was 9 of 23 from the field, primarily because he was 6 of 17 from behind the arc. So that's a little bit suboptimal for him. But aside from James, you look at your starters. Those guys that I've been talking about that need to step up their games, Ryan Anderson, Trevor Ariza, your trusty vets, yeah, they did exactly that. I'm sure it felt great for Ryan to have a big game in Madison Square Garden the way the Knicks basically treated him like a pile of garbage this summer to the media. I mean, it's ridiculous how many folks, just based on the Carmelo Anthony trade negotiations, convince themselves that Ryan Anderson does not know how to play basketball. In reality, I understand the contract concerns, but he's still a quality basketball player. And, this game the Knicks played was just a joke. And I love, by the way, that Ryan went out of his way to call out the Knicks and also Carmelo's camp for, playing leverage games through the media. But yeah, Ryan plus 16 in his 31 minutes, 21 points, 7 of 13 shooting. And actually, he was only 2 of 8 from 3. He was 5 of 5 from inside the arc. So Ryan showed you some diversity in his game. When the threes aren't falling, he found other ways to get involved. Trevor Ariza, 5 of 9 from the field, 16 points, 4 of 8 from behind the arc. Eric Gordon, 17 points, 4 of 8 from behind the arc. Same as Ariza, who had 16 points on 4 of 8 from behind the arc. So your variables, your veterans in the starting lineup, these are the guys that you probably needed to step up the most, and they did. Clint Capella, another solid game for him in the middle, 12 points, 13 rebounds, 6 of 10 from the field, 3 blocks, which is always great to see him stepping up as a defensive presence. Yesterday's episode, I broke down, why the Rockets allegedly in February considered a trade that would have sent out Clint Capella and more assets to the Clippers for DeAndre Jordan. Well, DeAndre's a better defensive presence, but with Clint, you want to see growth on that end. And so you see a guy with 13 rebounds, 3 blocks in 28 minutes, and no fouls, by the way. Yeah, 13 rebounds, 3 blocks, no fouls in 28 minutes. That's what rim protectors do. So I thought it was an encouraging showing from a defensive perspective as well. It's nice you can hold the Knicks under 100 points, even though they scored 27 in the first. I thought the Rockets' defense buckled down when it needed to. And then, of course, off the bench, Lupa Mute, he's been your best bench player this season by far. And he's actually started a couple of games when Trevor was out. But 10 points, a bench best plus 17 in his 24 minutes, 4 of 8 from the field, 2 of 4 from behind the arc. And really, he's had to pick up a lot of the slack for P.J. Tucker. Now, P.J. played about the same minutes, P.J. 26, Luke 24. But again, P.J. was 1 of 4, and you can tell that P.J.'s not quite all the way there because of the hamstring injury. He was not ready to go in training camp. Luke has picked up a lot of the slack, even picking up some better defenders that you would otherwise think might go to Tucker. And so you see Luke playing this well. Remember, Luke's the minimum signing. You signed Luke for the minimum. P.J. was the guy you gave almost full mid-level exception money to. So Luke, give him credit as a minimum signing. Him stepping up has helped mitigate some of the deficiencies. And again, I'm not worried about P.J. Tucker. Just look back at the Golden State game when he was brilliant. He's a veteran. When it matters, when he gets healthy, and especially when the lights are brightest, he's going to be fine. He knows what he's doing. But over the course of 82 games, a grind? Yeah, you need unexpected contributions here and there. And that's what guys like Luke Bamute are providing in this case. Wasn't a great night for the bench. Again, it was generally the starters, but Luke in his 24 minutes plus 17 off the bench, and then that goes with the entire starting lineup, which had enormous plus minus figures to the positive. Ryan and Capella plus 16, Trevor plus 15, and then Harden plus 21, and Eric Gordon a team best plus 23, and you'd expect that from a backcourt that's good. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to make that big of a deal about blowing out the Knicks, because certainly the Rockets are a better team. So these individual results, no, it doesn't tell you that much about exactly what the direction of this season is going to be, yada, yada. But it is good to see the guys who have been disappointed in this year, especially lately, the two-game losing streak heading into this one, Ryan, Trevor, they stepped up. In the case of Ryan, it wasn't just about getting hot. He actually made things happen inside the arc as well. But more than any individual player, what I liked from this game was to just see the commitment the Rockets played with in terms of energy, swarming defense, going to the bucket. I just thought it was a direct correlation with the way the focus comments, the energy, the grit, the grind that we heard from Mike D'Antoni after Monday's loss to Philadelphia. And it's a very long season. This is just one game out of many. So I'm certainly not going to act like that the corner has been turned or anything like that. There's going to be lots and peaks and valleys, especially without Chris Paul, which I'm going to touch on in just a moment as we close out the show. But aside from the fact that you have those peaks and valleys, you do want to see generally that your team is going to respond when their back is against the wall, when they're called out, and the Rockets did exactly that on Wednesday night in New York. And of course, because of it, they got to watch the Astros game in Game 7, and so did most Astros fans, or Rockets fans, who many, of course, also enjoy the Astros. So props to the Rockets for that. Last thing I want to talk about before we wrap up, and I know we've gone long today, but this is such a busy day in Houston sports. Hopefully you can bear with me. I've seen some pessimism based on a report from Mike Green, because it was a national game for ESPN. You have some national media getting exclusive interviews with the Rockets, and they asked Mike D'Antoni about Chris Paul, and he mentioned that it could be another 2 weeks or so. And that, you know, I know a lot of Rockets fans, especially after Monday, we've talked about the need for Chris Paul to come back, and I get it. He's a top 10 player in the league, and this team is designed to where the sum is greater than the individual parts, in large part because of the synergies based of having two Hall of Fame point guards and one of them on the floor at all times. So yeah, we miss Chris Paul, and fans want him back. But I don't think that there's any cause for alarm based on the timetable that was provided to the ESPN crew. That's what I want to push back against, because we were told, and of course the Rockets never said an exact timetable, but this was what was leaked to first Mark Stein in the New York Times, then Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN. We were told on Friday the 21st of October, I believe. Was that the 21st or 20th? But anyway, it was the Friday of the opening week. We were told that it would be, well, 4 weeks, the initial report, and then Adrian Wojnarowski said 2 to 4. Well, folks, it has not even been 2 weeks. It's been like 12 days since we heard that the absence, you know, he first missed that Wednesday game in Sacramento. I believe that was the 18th. So yeah, Friday would have been the 20th. But yeah, last night was just 2 weeks from when he first missed the game, and it hasn't even been 2 weeks from when that 2 to 4 week diagnosis came out. So if it's two more weeks, that's entirely within the original timetable. So no, I don't think that there's any setback or any cause for alarm. They're still within the timetable. Secondly, as I said in the case of last week's injury with Trevor Ariza, Ariza was ruled out for the entire road trip, and we later learned that the Rockets were expecting to be out even longer than that, and D'Antoni expected it to be a week's injury rather than days. Well, what ended up happening? He played before the end of the road trip, even though he'd been ruled out. He came back Saturday in Memphis. So all these timetables are subject to change. And I wish we always got the truth, but the reality is they're not required to tell us the truth, and sometimes they may believe it's to their competitive advantage not to. So, yes, I know what we're told in the media, but sometimes these timetables are not entirely accurate. It's just a matter of how Chris feels, and it's entirely possible that he feels better sooner than 2 weeks. He might feel better this weekend and be able to play. Daryl Morey said on a podcast the other day that if these were the playoffs, Chris would be playing. And that game in Golden State, even though he was limited as a shooter, certainly 11 assists to one turnover. I believe he had 8 rebounds, good defense, on Stephen Curry. No, I'm not worried about Chris Paul. He's going to be fine. It's a matter of healing. And in terms of his timetable, a lot of what you hear, these 2 to 4 weeks, what they don't want is a distraction. They don't want media fans wondering, is this the game Chris comes back? And then if it's not, then all this gossip, all this wondering, is he playing, is he not? They don't want to filter it into the locker room. They want the Rockets to play with what they have, to focus one game at a time with the roster they have. And then when Chris is back, he's back. And it might be sooner than the 2 weeks. I just think the timetable of 2 to 4 weeks is basically the Rockets saying, get off our back. We don't really know. Just hang in there. It is what it is for right now. And it could easily be sooner. It's not like, you know, it's not like there's no precedent for it. We just saw it with Trevor Ariza, who was ruled out and then returned. So I would not take any of these timetables too literally. But even if you do, it's still within that original 2 to 4 week timetable, even if it's 2 more weeks from right now. But I'm not convinced that just because D'Antoni says that it's going to be 2 weeks. I think they're just talking, they're just talking in generalities about what it could be. And as far as the particulars, they'll watch Chris every day and they'll see how he feels and they'll judge accordingly. So that's where I think things are. I'm not any more worried about Chris Paul. They do need him back. They're going to be a much better basketball team when he's back. And of course, there is going to be an integration process. I'm very aware of those things. So I do want Chris to come back, but you know, you want him to come back when he's ready. You want this this bruised knee to get fully healed so that it's not a lingering issue throughout the balance of the season, because the Rockets need to be clicking on all cylinders to have any real shot against teams as great as the Warriors in the playoffs. So I know it's frustrating, but my advice, folks, just be patient, let it play out, and no, I'm not any more worried about Chris Paul based on the comments from Mike Breen and the ESPN crew last night than I was before that. So, all that said, I'll finally wrap up this episode. Again, apologies for going long, but I know there's a lot to discuss, or at least there's a lot on my mind with the Astros, and I think there's some cool lessons to take from that as far as how they pertain to the Rockets. And, of course, well, the Rockets had a game last night when they played very, very well. So, a lot to discuss. Thanks, as always, for bearing with me. If you're not already following me or the show on Twitter, please do. I'm at Ben Dubose. The show is at Locked On Rockets. Also, email us, lockedonrockets@gmail.com. If you've got questions, suggestions, advertising inquiries, anything we can do to make this a better program for you, the diehard Rockets fan. Once again, happy, happy finals all around for Houston on Wednesday night. Rockets 119, Knicks 97. Rockets now 6-3 on the young NBA season. And, of course, more importantly, Astros 5. Dodgers won. Astros, your 2017 world champions. So what a day in Houston sports. My favorite hashtag, Houston sports is no more. Enjoy it, Houston. Great night for the Rockets. Even better one for the Astros. And, well, fun days ahead. Tomorrow, Astros parade downtown. And then Rockets take on the Hawks in Atlanta that night. So lots to do and talk about tomorrow. Hope to see some of y'all downtown in the afternoon, and then, of course, later in the evening. Look forward to talking with you guys on Twitter and right here on Locked On Rockets as the Rockets take on the Hawks. Until then, have a good one, guys.